This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden says that he will stick with his August 31st deadline for finishing a U.S.-led evacuation of Americans, at-risk Afghans, and others. He said the longer troops remain at the airport, the greater the risk of attacks by terror groups. The decision opens him up to criticism for caving to the Taliban, who say they will not permit the evacuation to go on much longer, and the prospect that some people who want to leave will be left behind. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the major industrialized nations will not recognize the Taliban government unless it guarantees people can leave the country. And again, the Taliban's main spokesman said on Tuesday that it expects foreign evacuations from Kabul to be completed by the end of the month, urging Afghans to stay to help rebuild their country. And a news conference said that continued the conciliatory messaging put out by the movement since its lightning seizure of Kabul on August 15th. The spokesman said the focus was on clearing up and improving security there. He said the movement had not agreed to an extension of the August 31st deadline set by the United States to pull out of Afghanistan and wanted all evacuations to end by that date. He said crowds thronging outside the airport could go home and their security would be guaranteed, and called on the United States not to encourage trained Afghans to leave their country. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris's trip to Singapore to Vietnam was delayed several hours Tuesday by an investigation into two possible cases in Hanoi, the so-called Havana syndrome. The word comes from administration officials. The investigation was in early stages, and officials deemed it safe for Harris to make her scheduled stop in Vietnam, which is part of her trip across Asia meant to reassure allies about American foreign policy. This is VOA News. A few weeks into the new school year, growing numbers of U.S. districts have halted in-person learning or switched to hybrid models because of rapidly mounting coronavirus infections. The setbacks in mostly small rural districts that were among the first to go back are dampening hopes for a sustained widespread return to classrooms after 2 years of schooling disrupted by the pandemic. More than 80 school districts or charter networks have closed or delayed in-person schooling in at least one entire school in more than a dozen states. Others have sent home whole grade levels or asked half of their students to stay home on hybrid schedules. The number of new coronavirus cases each day in Israel is nearing the record set in January. The government reported Tuesday that 9,831 new cases had been registered a day earlier, the highest count since a record of more than 10,000 new cases was set in mid-January. The number is notable because more than 5.5 million of Israel's 9.3 million people have received two doses of the vaccine, one of the fastest vaccination drives in the world. In recent weeks, the Delta variant has driven a surge of new infections and with it, new restrictions. Nearly 1.6 million people have received a third jab. The U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to block a court ruling ordering the Biden administration to reinstate a Trump-era policy that forces people to wait in Mexico while seeking asylum in the United States. With the three liberal justices in dissent, the court said Tuesday that the administration likely violated federal law in its efforts to rescind the program and formerly known as Remain in Mexico. A federal judge in Texas had previously ordered that the program be reinstated last week. Both he and the Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals refused the administration's request to put the ruling on hold. The justice, Samuel Alito, ordered a brief delay to allow the full court time to consider the administration's appeal. Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts has died at the age of 80. The publicist Bernard Daugherty said Tuesday that Watts passed away peacefully in a London hospital earlier, surrounded by his family. The unshakable drummer helped anchor one of rock's greatest rhythm sections for more than half a century and used his day job to support his enduring love of jazz. Watts had announced he would not tour with the Stones in 2021 because of an undefined health issue. He joined the Stones early in 1963 and ranked just behind Mick Jagger and Keith Richards as the group's longest-lasting and most essential member. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambia's new president says his government will promote democratic principles.
We will enforce the rule of law, we will enforce respect for people's rights, we will also make sure that we take away draconianism. There will be no abuse of the public order.
Armed men attacked Nigeria's Defense Academy, killing two. Cameroon says 40 villages are destroyed and thousands displaced. Somalia is to reopen primary and secondary schools despite new COVID infections. And victims react to former Chadian President Issa Habre's death.
All the African dictators have to learn a lesson, because you can be a dictator one day, the law will catch you.
And volunteers tackle COVID-19 vaccine hesitancy in South Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambia's new president, Hakainde Hichilema, says his government will promote democratic principles, including the rule of law, separation of the three branches of government, respect for fundamental human rights, and freedom of the press. Mr. Hichilema was sworn in yesterday, Tuesday, an event attended by a dozen African leaders and other governmental and international representatives. In this exclusive interview, granted to viewers Peter Clotty prior to his inauguration, Mr. Hichilema says Zambia hopes to strengthen relations with other countries, including the United States, the European Union, and other African countries.
To reinforce the rule of law, we reinforce respect for people's rights. We will also make sure that we take away draconianism.
Including the Public Order Act?
Absolutely. I'm coming there. There will be no abuse of the Public Order Act. The way it is, which was deliberately being misconstrued, that you need a permit from the police to hold a meeting. The Supreme Court ruled that you don't need a permit. You don't need anyone to authorize you or not. You just need to notify the police that I have a meeting in such a place on this day. The police are aware. If they sense that there could be an issue, they come to supervise. If not, you use what you call your own marshals, and you hold a meeting. But over time, by this exiting regime, they interpreted the Public Order Act wrongly to mean you need a permit. No, you don't. So the first thing we'll do is clear that no one needs a permit, no one needs license from anybody to hold a meeting.
Mr. President, under your leadership, how do you want the already warm relations between Washington and Lusaka to be under your leadership?
Much better. Much better in the sense that we have shared our vision. Our values are very clear. We espouse clear values, constitutionalism, democracy, and democratic space to all in accordance to our constitution, in accordance to subsidiary laws. We ascribe the rule of law, respecting fundamental human rights, liberties, and freedoms. These open up brains, human deep machine called the brain, God gave us. Once you have these conditions, the brain functions and becomes entrepreneurial, innovative, and is creative. That's what grows the economy. That's what brings jobs to the table. We want this to be seen in that context. What else? Strengthening institutions. Building institutions, getting them to be professional. Police, anti-corruption commission, auditor general, separation of powers, parliament, legislature, doing its duty. Three arms of government. Executive, knowing its excesses. Judiciary, being truly the beacon of justice in a country. Fourth estate, the media, must self-regulate, responsible, not excessive, balanced. That's what we believe in. And we believe in this environment, a free world, an economy that works for all. Now, all of this package, I think it's aligned to countries in the free world, including the country you mentioned. And since this is the case, I think we need to support each other. We need to strengthen our relationship. We want to learn from others who've done it better. We want the understanding of other societies, other democracies around the world, so that we can deepen our own democratic institutions and other related aspects.
Mr. President, what role do you think Zambia can play under your leadership in promoting democracy within the SADC region and by extension Africa?
We think that we have already sent a signal that We are a child of democracy. We are a product of democracy. Basically, you can call us, we achieved what Napoleon couldn't, a mission impossible. You are arrested this way, that way, that. You can't campaign. You still win the way we want. So it means we sent a message to people. If we're a product of democracy, free will of the people, and we got elected under all odds, against all odds, honestly, we are a good example of how democracy must evolve, even under brutal conditions. So I think what we did, what the people of Zambia did, I'm sure other African countries are watching. And they're saying, no, we can do it the way Zambia did it.
That was Zambia's newly elected president, Hakainde Hichilema, speaking with viewers Peter Clotty in an exclusive interview granted prior to his inauguration. Armed men in Nigeria have attacked the Nigerian Defense Academy, the NDA, in Kaduna State, killing two officers and abducting a third. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
The Defense Academy's public relations officer, Bashir Mahud Jajira, confirmed what he called a security breach in a statement. He said the dead officers were a lieutenant commander and a flight lieutenant in the Navy and Air Force, respectively, while the abducted one is a major in the Army. He also said an officer who was wounded during the attack is being treated. Jajira said a search team comprising of the Army, Air Force, and other security agencies have begun a rescue mission. An unspecified number of gunmen gained entry into the Defense Academy about 1 a.m. local time Tuesday. The attack highlights the growing violence in Nigeria by criminal groups often operating in the country's northwestern region. Last week, tens of people were killed in sectarian violence in southern Kaduna State. In northwest Zamfara State, gunmen abducted some 75 people Saturday after killing at least four. The abductees are yet to be freed. Darlington Abdullahi, vice president of the Nigerian Defense Alumni Association, explains why the attacks persist despite security forces' efforts to stem the crisis.
The forests that they are operating, they are more used to forest life than the people or than the security personnel, you know, that now have to move into some of those areas. So, and I mean, coupled with the fact that every care must be taken before you approach the forest, before you try to attack them in the, take on them in the forest.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took office in 2015 on the promise he would end widespread insecurity in the country. Last week, Buhari met with security heads and said he does not want to leave office as a failure. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Cameroonian authorities are urging thousands of villagers who fled northern Cameroon after a violent conflict between herders and fishers this week to return home. The villagers fled across the border into neighboring Chad after clashes over resources left farms and villages destroyed. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon says the conflict between cattle ranchers and fishermen has displaced people in Logone and Shari villages, but residents are reluctant to return due to concerns of ongoing violence in the country's northern border with Chad. Mijiyawa Bakari is the governor of Cameroon's far north region, where the Logone and Shari division is located. Bakari insists that Mosgum fishermen and Arab Shua cattle ranchers are fighting over water resources to maintain control over their natural habitats. He wants all civilians to know that Mosgum fishermen also clash among themselves over water in fishing areas. He adds that the Arab Shua cattle ranchers have informed Cameroon government officials on several occasions that their peers allow cattle to stray out of ranches in search of water, causing tensions between Arab Shua cattle ranchers. Last week, the Central African nation reported that at least 11,000 civilians were displaced by conflicts between Mosgum fishermen and Arab Shua cattle ranchers over water usage. Cameroon said 10,000 civilians jumped across the Logone River separating Cameroon and Chad to Chadian border towns and villages. Kamsulum Abba Kabi is an Arab Shura community leader and a lawmaker in Cameroon National Assembly's lower house of parliament. He says peace is gradually returning to both communities.
Nous déployons sur le terrain pour appeler nos frères qui sont sur place.
He is pleading with displaced Arab Shura community in Cameroon and Chad to return home, he says, seeking peace and hoping to reconcile. He has called on the Arab Shura community members in Logone and Shari, an administrative unit on Cameroon's northern border with Chad, to drop their weapons for peace and return. Cameroon President Paul Biya held a fifth crisis meeting in Kuseri, the capital of Logone and Shari Division, Monday. During the meeting, it was reported that 43 people have been killed and more than 100 wounded in the clashes, including 40 villages burned. Juanbe Ahmad, a fisherman and spokesperson of the Musgum community, says civilians fear returning because their livelihoods have been destroyed.
Cette crise a dégénéré ayant un impact considérable sur le plan.
It is difficult for displaced Musgum fishermen and their families to return when their villages have been burnt down and fishing lands destroyed, he says. The social and economic consequences of the clashes are enormous, he says, and many men were killed, and their wives and children do not know who to rely on. Bakari said the government will be sending assistance to the victims, but did not say when. He, however, distributed food and mattresses to at least 200 displaced people who returned on Monday. Moki Edwin Kinzeka. For VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, August 25th. Somalia this month announced it will reopen primary and secondary schools despite a new wave of coronavirus infections. Somalia's poor infrastructure meant most children could not do distance learning and not in school, where they will be exposed to risks. But as Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, there are still concerns about measures to prevent the virus from spreading in schools.
Early morning in a Mogadishu school, students arrived to prepare for the day's activities. None of the students are wearing a mask as they mingle among each other, even though Somalia is experiencing a new wave of COVID-19 infections. Khadija Adam is the school principal and administrator responsible for day-to-day operations. Khadija has a daunting task ahead, trying to keep her students safe while in school. She says we keep reminding our students about good sanitation. The students understand that they must wash hands. The education ministry, she added, supported the school by providing hand-washing facilities, but also cited that it is compulsory for students to wash their hands and wear masks, as this will enable schools to remain open. The vaccination rate in Somalia for COVID-19 remains low. The most vulnerable are the elderly, and there is fear school reopenings may increase infections among students who will ultimately expose their families. A student Abdel Fattah Muhyiddin fears for his older relatives. He says he is worried about the coronavirus as it has returned and reached a peak. Muhyiddin also said he has been worried about his family's health since his school reopened. I might get infected in school and take the virus back to my family, he said. The prolonged closure of schools because of the pandemic has had a negative impact on the lives of young Somalis. There was a significant increase in school dropouts, both for girls and boys, and this disrupted the social and economic well-being of families. Abdel Fattah Mahmoud is a merchant in Mogadishu, and after work, takes time in the evenings to mentor his two teenage daughters, hoping they will catch up on their studies to make up for lost time. The lockdown negatively affected education, Abdel Fattah said. The period was so long, and some of the students, especially girls, got disappointed with education and got married and started families. Abdel Fattah added the boys became either touts on passenger vehicles or migrated to other places. So the length of the lockdown really had an impact on schooling, he said. The long closure led to massive dropout rates, and some schools, even in the capital Mogadishu, have been forced to close. The Director General of Somalia's Education Ministry, Mohamed Abiy, recognizes that the schools are undergoing hardships. Abiy said the government is implementing plans to mitigate any upsurge of infections, but he acknowledged the disruption have affected academic performance. Abiy says that even the few students who showed resilience to continue with their studies performed poorly during exams. He said the performance of students graduating from middle and secondary schools for the past 2 years was below average, unlike any other time in the past. In announcing the reopening of schools, Somalia's education ministry promised that preventive measures were in place to ensure learning returns to normal. Students are required to wear face masks and maintain social distancing, among other measures. But because the pandemic is continuing, in the worst-case scenario, the ministry has recorded all the lessons from primary schools. Ministry head Abiy says students will have access to those audio and video lessons to ensure that education is not disrupted. The education ministry is also setting up platforms that will be accessible through mobile phones and computers. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
The president of the Association of the Victims of Eastern Habre says the death of the former Chadian president should send a message to other would-be African dictators that they can kill or violate the rights of their citizens, but one day the law will catch up with them. Habre, who has been serving a life sentence in Senegal, passed away on Monday at the age of 79. A special African court found him guilty in 2016 for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during the 8 year he ruled, 1982 to 1990. The special court also ordered Habre to pay $33,000 to each of the estimated 7,400 victims of his abuses. Clement Abayifuta, president of the Association of Victims of Eastern Habre's Crimes, says he is not gloating over Mr. Habre's death because he knows that all human beings will one day die. However, Abayifuta says Habre's crimes were so egregious that his victims had no doubt that he would die in prison.
I want just to say that, you know, I'm not really surprised because as a human being, you're waiting to die. This is life, you know. Everyone is waiting to die. So, according to Eastern Habre case, he was judged and condemned to finish his life in the prison. As he died, I'm not in trouble because after the trial, everyone knows that Eastern Habre should die in the prison. So, I'm not emotional reacting, but his day on the earth is finished. Period.
What lessons do you think other would-be dictators in Africa should learn from the Habre case?
All the African dictators have to learn a lesson, because you can kill, you can be a dictator. One day, the law will catch you one day forever. Where you can establish, you can be catch, because when you run on the top of the house, you will one day stop. So all the dictators in Africa must know that the impunity is not a house or a condition to rule the country. So let them correct the way they are ruling the country. So it is an appeal. You have to change or not. You will meet the law. So all the dictators, they have to know one day they will finish. So before they finish, they have to correct the way that they deal with their country.
You are president of the Association of Victims of former President Habre's Crimes. Has there been any compensation for the victims?
No. 5 years passed without anything has been done. That is sorry for me, very, very sorry for me, because I don't know what exactly is or the reasons which block the compensation. I don't know, because all the mechanism is on the right way to be done. So I think that, you know, in Africa, when the politic interfere on the way of trial, usually is like this. But I think that things will change. So we will continue the battle until all the victims possess their compensation, their own compensation.
Thank you so much, Clement. It's always nice to speak with you.
Thank you very much, and take care.
Clement Abaifuta is the president of the Association of Victims of Former Chadian President Issen Habre's Crimes. He was speaking with us from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. Despite COVID-19 vaccine being available to all South African adults, uptake remains low, with just 20% of adults having received a first dose. The Muslim Association of South Africa is one of many groups combating vaccine hesitancy by delivering shots to doorsteps. Linda Givetage reports from Johannesburg.
Dawn Krotz received her Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine from a paramedic in the comfort of her South Johannesburg home. While the vaccine has been made available to the 64-year-old since April, Krotz says rumors about the side effects made her hesitate. But the reality of the deadly virus changed her mind.
I decided to get it because I saw my daughter-in-law's father got so sick and he passed away. And then I thought, hey, let me also get it. I take the flu vaccine every year. I go and they buy it and they give it to me. And then I thought, no, let me do this also.
With South Africa's COVID-19 death toll surpassing 79,000, volunteer health workers are scrambling to quell people's vaccine fears. The country's Muslim Association launched an at-home vaccination program to provide individual attention to allay concerns and to remove the barriers of traveling to a clinic. Mohammed Varachia is one of the paramedics delivering at-home vaccines.
I think it's just a misconception, people reading on social media, people hearing from different people, that it's bad for you, that it's man-made, how can we create a vaccine in a year, etc., etc. So there's a lot of hesitancy that we've come across, but we put the fears to bed.
Another problem is access to transportation and basic information about how one can get the vaccine, especially among the elderly. Ronel Berger is an economics professor at Stellenbosch University studying health inequality.
The registration for vaccines are electronic, and even though you can at sites also register, you need to know where the sites are before you can show up there.
For some people, like 22-year-old Kurt Fisher, who is quadriplegic, getting to a vaccine site is difficult both physically and mentally. While the rest of his family has been vaccinated, his father, Kevin Fisher, says having an at-home option for his son was a game changer.
I would have sacrificed not having it to give him my shot, if possible, that he's his first. The familiarity of being able to be in his house is a big benefit, that there's no stress involved going to a foreign venue.
Experts say volunteer efforts are closing the gap in vaccinating more people, especially the most vulnerable. President Cyril Ramaphosa applauded the country's youth on Monday for rushing to sites as vaccines were made available to those as young as 18. But experts warn that fears and other barriers still need to be addressed, or the latest uptick could fizzle out as it did among older age groups. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Wednesday, August 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Tracy Carter, who is filling in for Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to Ndombolo and Makossa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.